beach easy.
As soon as they hiked the ball, you know, I'm doing my assignment. And before I can even get the ball, I was crushed, you know, hit. And it's just, I guess my linemen's collapsed. I don't know what happened. You know, it was a failed assignment. I got taken out on a stretcher, you know. So actually they took me to the hospital. They did a CAT scan. And I guess it gave me a concussion to the point where they said that it was severe.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. From personal growth and self-discovery to challenges and victories, we discuss it all. Join us as we dive into the extraordinary stories of ordinary people all the way to the end.
Welcome to another episode of Life's a Beach and Then You Die. I'm Julie Ellis, and today I'm joined by John Smalls, a man who has always felt a deep connection to his ancestors. Growing up on a small farm in a place called the Free Woods, John had many role models who taught him how to work hard and live off the land.
It was a very tight-knit community, very tight, family-oriented community. Grandma and granddad stayed at the head of the road. And then further down the road, that's where my immediate family resided at. And then other family members down the road. And that's a place where we learn how to, you know, be sustainable.
Yeah.
And as well, how to, you know, take the reins and work as a young man.
Yeah.
So at that time, we had a lot of men present. So I had to, there was no excuses, you know.
Right.
There was no just hanging out in the house or trying to escape away from work. You did work.
And, well, your dad had a farm, right?
Well, my family had a farm.
Your family
and
did,
my
okay.
father was one of the, farm takers because, or farm, excuse me, farm caretakers. He had gardens all throughout Freewoods where he would actually plant sugarcane, butter beans, watermelons, cucumbers, corn, and things of that significance. And the reason he did that was because of his great-great-grandfather. Because of that area at that time, you know, pretty much all of America was farmers, especially the majority of the African Americans, they were farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And so my father picked that up, and that was just a traditional thing that he did. And
you paint a really lovely picture of growing up and having that, because I hope you don't mind if I ask you about the Gullah culture. First, I want to add, just for our listeners, that there are concerted efforts to keep the Gullah culture alive here in the area, down in Charleston and, you know, along the way up the coast. Mm-hmm. But for you, I mean, you know, 150 years ago, you had descendants that came out of slavery.
Yeah.
Right? Not all African-Americans in America can make that claim, right?
Because correct.
There's many ways that they arrived here.
Correct.
And not all came through from West Africa and landed in that.
Right.
And I just wonder, you know, growing up, what were you told about that? Was it like, yay, we're free and now we've got this life here? Or was there like some bitterness? Or what does that feel like? Can you describe that?
That's interesting you asked me that, because I speak to my son about those things, right? In our household, it was never talked about because of the fact that, again, you know, that was, I think that slavery part was a very small sliver in American history on top of all the other beautiful things that were going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mom and dad, especially my dad, we saw it as human trafficking. They didn't ever say slavery to us. So they seen it as human trafficking. So that's how I had recognized it and realized that these people are just prisoners. You know, we never saw them as slaves because of the fact of their geniusness and the things that they brought about and the way that they actually brought about e-commerce. And I think, you know, history got the bad side of good size. And having that holistic perspective, and I say holistic with the W, so having that whole 720 aspect of it, taking the positive and negative and finding the balance, because, you know, when you look at ocean, you know, the ocean is very strong, but as well, it's very calm.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a beautiful, beautiful body of work. History is a very beautiful body of work, but we learn from it if we decide to learn from it.
You just gave me chills again. I love it. So how would you describe yourself as a kid?
Ooh, very athletic, very strong, but very well-mannered. They did not play that. So
I was going to guess that.
Yeah, they did not play that. So, you know, if like I was to act up, I was to act up in the woods somewhere when no one's around, no adults around, and I could do and say whatever I want to say out there. But when I was around adults, it was just well-mannered, whatever I needed to do. Because of what was in my DNA, like you said, like I had that just that leader mentality and I didn't whine about stuff. So like, all right, you don't see me, you'll eventually see me because I'm going to do something good, you know, and that's going to bring light to what I'm doing. And not, hey, check me out, I want attention, but just anything I did is like I just had to put my heart into it. And I was very passionate about anything and everything I did.
Yeah.
Even if it was just picking up trash or even at the farm, like, oh, I got to scoop up manure, or when I go stay with my uncle in Columbia, I got to clean up dog doo-doo. It's like, all right, I'll be the best guy that's doing that, you know?
I love it.
I earned my keep.
John enjoyed a free-spirited childhood and learned a lot by observing the world around him. He spent most of his time outdoors, feeling like he was being watched over by something bigger as he played amongst the trees.
My mom and dad would go to work back then. It was okay for you to stay at home. And my mom would say, if you get scared, call your grandma or granddad. Your granddad would come pick you up. And I thought, I was like, yes, finally I'm growing up. You know, I'm starting to smell. They say smelling yourself. So it was like I felt like I was a grown man in the house by myself. But and she said, if I decided to play, I need to play in the backyard. So I never played in the front yard because we lived on a dirt road. And it was very scary at that time. So I would go in the backyard and play. And I was like, all right, the backyard's not big enough. Let me go venture off into the woods. So I started running in the woods and just start running. And like I felt like my ancestors was running with me and just being there. Like I was always protected during the summer because mom and dad was like, snakes going to bite you. And these things they call red bugs going to eat you up. But my whole entire life as a kid was spent in the woods during the summertime in deep woods that was never touched. And I never had issues with snakes or any wild predators, like, because I never had those attentions. And so, like, that's where I learned my skills at. I was just running, acting like there was a boar chasing me or something like that, and running through trees. And so.
But even as a young person, you felt, like, literally felt the presence of your ancestors.
Yes.
So you had a spiritual walk even when you were a child.
Yes, it was so strong. It was just there. I want to say when my grandma passed away, that was my first experience of really seeing and feeling someone. My mom and dad was sleeping in her room, and I was sleeping on the pull-out couch. And I just remember her coming back and seeing me clear as day and night. Like, I would never forget this. And that's always been a very strong place in my heart, or even it's been significant in my life. And that just lathered me. It smothered me, and it carried me throughout my life. It allowed me to avoid situations that could have been terrible for me.
Yep.
You know, my life could have been so much different. But again, those ancestors, those spiritual beings that I didn't see, they was like, we're going to pull you away real quick. And it's like, man, if you'd have stayed a couple seconds longer or a minute longer, it probably wouldn't be here this day to talk to you.
John recognized the influence his ancestors had on his life. As a young boy, he received a gift from a family member that sparked an excitement for football, a sport that would come to define much of his early life.
I want to say it began when my father's mother, Grandma Grace, but she gave me my first football helmet. And that's one of the only pictures that I remember that they captured when I was a kid, you know, back in the 80s.
Oh, really?
So I was like, that really was dear to me. But I guess once she gave me that helmet, I got excited. But I didn't know truly about football. I wasn't inside a house like that on Sundays when football was going on, or Saturdays. So when I met these other kids, they were playing football. So I was like, I want to play too. And I played with them. But I want to say about third grade, Surfside Recreation Department started, or they had football going on. And I heard the kids talking about it at school. And I told my dad, I was like, I want to play football. He's like, you sure you want to play football? Mm-hmm. And at the time, we didn't have flag football. It was all tackle football.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right. He's like, you sure? So he went there, signed me up. You know, I'm in the first day putting those pads on. I was nervous. I was scared. I was like, everybody's bigger than me, whatever. And it was, my dad was like, don't worry about it, son. You know, it's a legal fight. You know what I'm saying? So take all the anger that you got, you know, go out there and release. You know, the first year was, it was okay. You know, I wasn't terrible, but I wasn't the best. But that second year, once I grew into myself and found that confidence and I took all that playing I would do in the woods and I turned those trees and those holes and those rabbits that I used to chase and those trees I tried to run over, I turned those into people on the field. It was over then. Like, they couldn't stop me. Like, it was just, it was all up from there, you know. My whole entire life, I was just awesome at football, you know. Running the football, scoring touchdowns, playing defense. I just had a natural knack.
Did you play football then in high school? Where did you go to high school?
Soxty High School. You know, once a Brave, always a Brave. I graduated in the class of 2002. In 1998, that was my freshman year. And I actually played JV football. They were trying to get me to play varsity football, but my mom said, no way, you ain't getting my baby out there playing varsity football. And I know I'm glad she didn't, you know, because that it gave me the opportunity to play JV football and to dominate. And that's what I did. I dominated. Yeah. And after that freshman year, there's like, and I went back to the JV team. They was like, no, you're coming varsity. One of my uncles that lived in Columbia, he was connected to a lot of NFL players that came out of that area. So I always got invited to go to some of those NFL youth camps that they did in the area. And then my mom and dad saw that I was getting out of hand. So it's like, you know what, you're going to go stay with your uncle. But it was perfect because I went to camps up there and played football.
Well, what do you mean getting out of hand?
Exploring. And, you know, and that's when TV, you know, became more common. You know, and you got these shows and you're seeing these things that other people have. So it's like, I want those things too. So you ask mom and dad, it's like, can I get that? And it's like, nope. And so it's like, all right, let me go find a job. So you go find a job and then, you know, you start making your own money. So you think you can buy anything and have anything. So, you know, you get exposed to other things. So obviously, as a teenager, I was exposed to marijuana and alcohol. And then again, you know, it was Myrtle Beach. And at that time, life was different here, you know, and I'm glad rules are getting strict now for the youth. But I know that, you know, and we all go through it, you know, that phase of just rebellion. So it was just like, who going to regulate us? We could go party, we could go live out our life, you know, and I really was living out a good life here in Myrtle Beach, especially being a star athlete.
John was a force to be reckoned with on the field. It seemed like nothing could stop him as he soared toward a promising football career. But in a twist of fate, his world came crashing down.
So I want to say my junior year homecoming game against Myrtle Beach Seahawks. And, you know, and maybe I wish I'd have said something to the coaches, but I remember that in a huddle with my quarterback and I kept telling him, hey, man, we need to switch the play. Something was telling me. Maybe it was the answers just telling me. It was telling me, like, we need to switch the play. And this was before halftime. And I was like, switch the play, man. He's like, no, coach said we got to run the ISO play. I was like, no, switch the play. He's like, no, we got to listen to coach. I was like, all right, whatever. So as soon as they hiked the ball, you know, I'm doing my assignment. And before I can even get the ball, I was crushed, you know, hit. And it's just, I guess my linemen's collapsed. I don't know what happened. You know, it was a fell assignment. I got taken out on a stretcher, you know. So actually they took me to the hospital. I think they did a CAT scan. And I guess it gave me a concussion to the point where they said that it was severe. And then they wanted me to stop playing contact sports.
Did you lose consciousness?
I did.
Oh, no.
So I just remember, you know, people coming by the house that next morning and that day, you know, checking on me, you know, because, you know, I'm always getting back up. And at that time, I didn't get back up. Mm-mm. And I guess it was destined for me to get hit like that. It was destined for me to have that injury.
Why? Because, why do you feel it was destined?
So at that time, my life was really moving fast, you know, because I knew I was going somewhere. And maybe I wasn't prepared for the life that was going to be given to me when I got on that level, because I know I would have been somewhere else. And I might have not done right with the money that I would receive, all the perks that I would receive. Who knows, you know? And so it stopped me, you know, and I'm glad
it slowed you down.
It slowed me down.
Yeah.
And it brought me back to the wholesomeness.
John's injury changed everything. Suddenly, the future John had worked so hard for was gone.
And the way I coped was to rebel. You know, I became more outgoing, more partying, because I was coping, I guess, from my emotions and what was happening.
Well, you think they were off from
that?
They
had been off. You know, I don't think I was I don't think I was really the same after that. Like, my life was...
I understand that.
It was just different, you know.
Yeah.
Now, you know, so not blaming them, but we could have came in and helped me rehabilitate better.
Yeah.
You know, we could have spent more time like, hey, let's get him a therapist. Because this guy was already destined to be a superstar. He was already a star what he was doing, but no, he was destined to be a superstar. And like, I turned down playing basketball that following season, and I played varsity basketball ever since a freshman. So I'm with one of the best high school coaches ever, and you know, and I said no to playing basketball, you know, and blew my mind.
Well, that's the thing with a brain injury like that. You look fine.
Right.
You know, and so people don't think you need help.
Mm-hmm.
They just think you need an attitude adjustment or whatever is wrong, you know?
Right.
And I think they've come a long way with traumatic brain injury, mm-hmm. things like that. But I know people who got them
right.
40 years ago that still struggle. It does change you.
And that's what scares me, too,
yeah.
you know? Because I can remember the doctors talking to my mom and dad, and you know, it's like, oh, man, this is scary. It's like your son could be a vegetable if he decided to play contact sports again. I was like, what? So it was like, whoa, what is this? You know, it's like, I felt broken. It's probably the first time, but like, I started sneaking out of the room window and just, even though everybody was sleeping, I was sneaking out of the house just to go in the woods, just to get away. And I was like, you know what? I'm done with high school. I'm going to drop out. I'm just going to live off the land. And that's all I wanted. Like,
oh,
it was just
wow.
me and the trees, you know, and the deers and whatever. But like, I felt like I was in a serene environment. I was in a, they understood me, you know, nature
yeah.
understood me and they protected me.
Did you cry?
I didn't have emotions then. Like, it's crazy.
yeah.
Like, I thought I was a tough guy, you know, maybe because there's things that was supposed to make me cry, but I couldn't cry.
Yeah.
And I didn't cry until, I want to say until my dad passed away. That was the first time I cried since a teenager. You know, after that injury, I never had those type of emotions.
After a year filled with ups and downs, John was searching for meaning and purpose in his life again. It wasn't until the summer before his senior year that he realized something needed to change.
My summer was different that time, going into my senior year, because normally my summers would be consist of strictly sports. Up there with my uncle, training with the guys, with his buddies, whatever, in football. Just being around him. But that summer, I think I was working at Oceanfront Bar and Grill, and I'm sitting there working, you know, just regular. It's like, because I never thought that would be me. You know, I do pick up little hustle jobs with my uncle or cut grass or whatever, but never thought I'd have a regular. I'm not knocking that type of work, but I never thought I'd be doing that type of work. And so I'm sitting, I was like, what am I doing? You're like, this is not me. Like, I'm confined back here, you know, hanging out with these people in the kitchen, you know, that's whatever. But I emitted a different type of light. I never said I was too big for the job, but it's just like, all right, I got another purpose. So I say that summer, I was like, you know what? I got to get this together. So I came very supportive of the team. And then, but as well, I sat down with my high school basketball coach, Coach D, you know, and, you know, obviously he opened me welcome arms. Like, yeah, you know, you got to come back. So played and, you know, and I earned my keep. Like, you know, what I could remember was being recruited. One of the teams that was being recruiting me was Coastal Carolina University. But at that time, to me, Coastal was just too small. Maybe it could have been the right fit for me, but I was like, I needed to get away. And then I want to say I had got an offer to play, I guess, like a D1 junior college. So I went down to Florida and played JUCO basketball down there. As time grew on, like, I saw that the passion for the sport wasn't really there. But I allowed a semester, you know. I did, matter of fact, I did a whole entire year. And so Well, I called my brother first. Like, hey, you got to come pick me up.
Like, why didn't you want to be there? What didn't you like about it?
You know, because I always, every game, right, even in the other college, I always had college football coaches like, hey, you can come play football? We need you to play football.
Aww.
And then even when I got to Campbellsville, they had a football team. Oh, man, we need you on the football field. So, like, it killed me. It crushed me. Even though I worked hard on that court, like, you know, and I know I was one of the best teammates. I know, you know, like, I challenged everybody. But I realized, like, man, it's like, I miss football.
As John mourned the football career that could have been, he realized he could never find fulfillment through basketball. He dropped out of college and moved back to Columbia.
Even though I went to school in Florida and Kentucky on my own, but this was my first time as an adult, young adult, being on my own. Even though I had my uncle down the road, at the same time, I was still on my own. And I had a very prominent, significant person that lived next door to me. People probably wouldn't know, his name was Piezo, right? And so, you know, he was somebody that, man, you know, he kept reminding me that this is not the way you want to live. He's like, every time we have a conversation, like, dude, you're intelligent. Like, what are you doing? Like, even like with your physique, man, you could be a model, you could be a fireman, you could do this, you could do that. But like, what are you doing? Like, why you want to hang around this rap culture? You know, that life was just different in Columbia. So what I was able to see being next to him and in that neighborhood, it was like, whoa, this is not what I want to live. You know, how did I get here? This is not how I was raised, and I need to choose a different route. The day that really changed my life when, you know, taking up a whole entire street, the police department, and not realizing I was in an area that was being under surveillance, and it really dawned on me that day when, you know, it's like I drive into the house and I have a guy in the neighborhood say, hey, don't go up the street. You know, your houses are blocked off. Blocked off for what? And he was like, yeah, there's a bunch of cops over there. I was like, huh? Cops? For what? And apparently, you know, that area was being under surveillance for a long time, and I didn't know, you know. But I wasn't involved with those type of activities, but I was next to them, and I was always near them. They had a lot of, you know, groups up there in Columbia that probably, I guess, had a bad rap. And I was near one of those groups, and he was probably one of the head... was the head guy of it, but I didn't see him as that because I felt like he was changing his life. And, you know, his wife comes out yelling and stuff and just seeing the stuff that they had to go through dealing with the forces.
Wow.
And the kids and that, and then him just looking at me, and I felt it. And then when I was able to go into my house and not being handcuffed or anything, going where he was going at, I was like, all right, I got to get my life together. There's another chance, John, you know, because on that field, you could have been dead or you could have been or paralyzed. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, here's another chance.
Piezo's arrest was a wake-up call for John, and he realized he was headed down the same path if he didn't take action. A week later, he took a walk downtown to figure out his next move.
I was walking to the Columbia Library, but this beautiful young lady was walking by, and I was like, ooh, I'm going to go talk to her. And so I follow her, and she was an Air Force recruiter. And so I follow her in the office and had no intentions of going to the military. None at all. But she was in the military uniform, so like, all right, I'm going to just talk to her, see whatever. And she was like, yeah. Then she told me what she was doing. And I guess the conversation really didn't go anywhere. And then I was leaving out of the office, and here comes this Marine recruiter, Sergeant Robinson. I would not forget Sergeant Robinson. And he was like, I can get you out of here. I'm like, get me out of here. What you mean? He's like, matter of fact, you know, we got sign-on bonuses. I was like, sign-on bonuses? And he was like, yeah. I was like, so how much you think I get? You know, they always offer you, they lowball you at first.
Oh, yeah.
So he was like, yeah, I'll get you about, if we said $5,000, I was like, all right, whatever. And I thought about it, and Sergeant Robinson, and then I thought about that day, you know, with Piezo sitting on the porch and him getting taken away. I was like, all right, I just need to get out of here. I want to say, I reached back out to him, and I was like, man, I got to go. And I ended up calling all my buddies that live down here. I was like, hey, y'all can have anything in my house. Take everything. I don't want no money. Y'all can have everything. I'm out of here.
Before he knew it, John found himself getting ready to leave for basic training. He felt a whirlwind of emotions and didn't quite know what he was getting himself into.
I was dropping the car off, but then happened, so I missed the van to go to the recruit depot, or whatever you want to call it, to catch the bus to go to Paris Island.
Whoops.
And so my sister, she ended up, you know, her and my dad, they ended up taking me, driving me all the way to Columbia, dropping me back off in front of that office where I followed that pretty young lady at. They dropped me off there, and that's where I got recruited, or got sent off at. And I got on that bus, and that ride, I remember I was trying to get sleep, but I couldn't get sleep. And it was very uncomfortable. And I just remember them, and we pulling up, going through that gate, and here comes this drill instructor on the bus yelling at us, like, what the You're heck like, is going oh, on
what
here?
What have I done?
What have I done? Yeah, exactly. Why? Why? It's like, why didn't I listen to PAs? I could have been a model. I could have been a fireman. I could have done anything else. Like, I decided to be a Marine for what? I want somebody just to yell at me? What? They're about to ruin my life. But, you know, so shell-shocked, you know, it was a rude awakening for me. It was different, you know? Mm-hmm. I was like, what did I really get myself into? Until they actually put me in a position of leadership. We was doing the honor or the ceremony. We were getting our EGA. Like, I really felt part of something. And, like, it gave me that, it fulfilled that void that I was missing mm-hmm. from football.
Were your parents very proud of you?
I think they were, you know? To see me accomplish that and to see me, you know, walk across that parade deck and to see me in the front. It was like, wow, you know, that's that guy.
After graduating from training, John found himself with his unit stationed in California. His experience as a Marine was about to get very real.
I actually went to Afghanistan. I was part of Operation Enduring Freedom in 2009 and 2010. And the funny thing about it, Sergeant Robinson, I'm gonna get you. Because when I told him I signed up, it was like, and he gave me that bonus, right? And he was like, yeah, it's like, I don't want to deploy. And I told him that. I was like, I don't want to deploy. He's like, nah, you ain't gonna deploy. You're
oh,
good.
Yeah, they tell him.
It's like, yeah, you know, like, I want to go finish school. He was like, yeah, you good. We got you. It's like, yeah. It's like, all right, cool. And I get to my unit in California. It's like, you know, the guys that was just coming back from Iraq, too. It's like, all right, cool. You're like, yes, you know, I ain't got to go. So you think units don't deploy back to back. That's what it was said. But apparently, I want to say a couple months back after everybody got off of leave, I want to say the platoon sergeant or whatever, you heard the little rumors. And eventually they gave us, it was like, oh, yeah, we're about to deploy to Afghanistan. I was like,
oh.
Deployed to Afghanistan. It's like, what? It's like, my heart dropped. Everything was like, I'm about to die. You know, that's the first thing you think in your mind. It's like, yo, I can't go. How do I get out of this?
They're like, you're a Marine, like, son. No. You're not getting out.
It's like, what? I was like, oh my God. So, like, but at the same time, I was a meritorious Marine too. So I went to the fleet, not as a regular Marine. I went to the fleet as a private first class, and I want to say a week later, I got promoted to Lance Corporal. And so, like, I was on the fast track. And then, I want to say, before I deployed to Afghanistan, I became a corporal meritoriously. So I had to go on board and, you know, be amongst the first sergeant and officers and them like that, you know, and be one of the sharpest. And I was one of the sharpest. And they took a liking of me, you know, and it was like almost like a poster child.
John and his unit left for Afghanistan. They arrived in Camp Leatherneck, where they stayed for a while before being transferred to a smaller camp in the South Desert.
And then I realized, like, okay, I'm going to a place that's not normal and it don't have as much protection as Leatherneck. So, you know, I get flown out to Delaram. You know, it was a little bit more different out there than it was at Leatherneck. And it was a lot smaller. It was like a sitting target out there in the middle of nothing.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Anybody come in your can, you know, these things are made out of nothing. Like, bullets could fly through anything. And, like, we got these bunkers that when the alarm goes off, we go get in the bunker because there's an imminent threat. That happened a lot. And even when we flew in, I guess we were maybe targeted. I don't know if it was targeted. But I just knew that the helicopter driver, he had to fly a little bit different to fly us into where we were going at. So I was like, whoa. As soon as we get off that bird, it was like, we got to go straight into the bunker. It's like, what is going on here? Is this the life I'm about to live? Because I had just left Columbia. You know, it's like, yo.
You're like, I didn't want to get shot there. Yeah, I don't want to get shot here.
Exactly. It's like, man.
Well, what kind of things did you learn?
I just learned, like, you know, the world is watching us. And when they watch us, they're only seeing what they're being exposed to. And I had a reminder of, like, don't put us all in the same boat, even though we want to. But again, you know, just like with animals in nature, you know, they're going to wing out the bad ones. You know, the bad ones going to be whatever they want to be. But the ones that's really taking care of the tribe and the pack, they're going to stick together and do what they need to do.
You learn the ways your perceptions are wrong, but you also learn how alike we all are.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and you face your fears, you know. You don't have to face your fears in front of the world, but you face your fears internally. Because you're in those situations, you know, where you have to overcome it. And you have, and once you overcome it, you look back, it's like, whoa, okay. But you look back, but you're still moving forward.
Right.
And it's okay to look back, but you still got to move forward. A lot of times people look back. I learned, that's one thing I learned too, though. It's like, to look back, but I keep moving forward. Because as well, you, whatever, if you want to say in patrols or however people would move, you're moving. You're constantly moving. You're moving your head on a swivel. You're looking, but you're moving. And I learned that we got to just keep moving because the world never stops moving. And that's how I played on the football field. You know, I'm going to figure this thing out. I'm going to figure out how to get a touchdown. I'm going to figure out how to put the team on my back. In basketball, I'm going to figure out how to get a rebound. I'm going to figure out if I need to score, I need to dunk on somebody, I need to block, whatever I need to do. At home, in the field, in the garden, you know, whatever. I'm going to figure this thing out. As a parent, I'm going to figure this thing out and keep moving.
After 4 years in the Marines, John felt it was time to move on. He began the challenging process of transitioning back to civilian life.
What'd you do after the Marine Corps?
So after the Marine Corps, as I was transitioning out, there's a program that they offered called a VSAT. So the VSAT was actually called a Veteran Agricultural Sustainable Training Program for veterans and active duty military. And so I was able to get a scholarship to go to this program while I was transitioning out. So I got involved with the program, but at the same time, I thought about my family. It's like, how can I evolve our family farm? As I went through the program, I want to say second week, you know, Colin lets us know, it was like, hey, you guys got to put together a business plan. A business plan, and you're going to present it to a board, and that's part of your final grade. So as I went through there, I actually decided to do, my project for that business plan was to do a clothing line. And I had a clothing line called Spitz Clothing. And I was going to use all organic material. I was going to take the sugar cane that we were growing and turn that into jeans. And even some of the cotton that we were growing, and make our own socks, underwear, T-shirts and stuff, all that cool stuff. Everything was going to be sustainable. You know, say nothing's going to get thrown away. Everything's going to be recyclable. I worked on that business plan, and it got to the point where it's like I had some buddies of mine that was part of this, who was helping with it, and they fell off. So I had to reconstruct my business plan on top of being in this class, and we had probably like 2 weeks before graduation, 2 weeks before to do the presentation. So I was like, oh, sweet potatoes. Oh, we grow sweet potatoes. Oh, I know I make a sweet potato pie, and at the time I was a vegetarian too. And so I learned how to, you know, cook and bake vegetarian-wise. So I made a vegetarian sweet potato pie, and I called my mom and my brothers, like, hey, I'm about to do this project. Can you guys bake me a sweet potato pie the way that y'all bake it here in Horry County? Mm-hmm. And so they actually, you know, rush delivered a sweet potato pie to me. And, you know, so, and I got the pie. I got my whole presentation. I got my PowerPoint ready. Got to the class. I was kind of late. I was nervous. I was like, man, I ain't going to show up. Like, this is going to be terrible. I don't want to do this. But I ended up showing up. And I had my classmates, I already had chopped it up. I was like, all right, so when I get up there and when I get to the financial part, right, I want y'all to start passing out the pies. Because I felt like my financial numbers weren't right. Because, you know, we're presenting a business plan. And if the business plan is good enough, you might have angel investors or somebody that's willing to invest in you. So as I was doing that, you know, I'm going over and got to the finances and they're passing out the pies. And I remember somebody said, stop, like, what are you talking about? It's like, you're done. You're finished. Like, finished? It's like, we like this. We like this. We need to talk to you after this is over. We want to help you start a business. We want you to turn a sweet potato pie business, sweet potatoes into a pie baking business for real. It's like, man, I just did this off a whim. Like, I really didn't have no true reasons to do it. I was just like, whatever. but it took off.
Once John completed the agriculture program, he felt the calling to dive deeper into his spiritual side and reconnect with the energy that has guided him throughout his life. He attended a holistic medicine school, driven by a dream of helping others on their health and wellness journeys.
When I graduated, like, I was like, man, this was the best experience ever. Like, wow. They saved my life. Like, that group of people I graduated with, like, we learned how to see each other naked. You know, we became transparent. You know, we came to the part of being, seeing each other's flaws, but as well growing and learning how to not just heal ourselves with our hands, but heal ourselves with our minds and allow others to help us with their gifts. I was able to build bridges bridges that was never ever built before. We was able to do leaps and bounds, and they was able to see something different. I was able to see something different. And even just with the work, we were able to bring our ancestors together with doing that work. We didn't understand, but we just, now we're getting clarity, and that's what was happening with our ancestors. Like, all right.
Well, you have an 8-year-old son now.
Yes.
And
Petra Jacoby Zinzi.
Tell me about what you want to pass on to your son, because you mentioned your dad just really wanted you to be better than him mm-hmm. through the generation. So as you're preparing your young man
yes.
to do better even than that you've done, how are you managing that?
Oh, my gosh. Like, parenting for me has been one of the easiest things ever in my life. Even better than me running a football, dunking a basketball, planting a seed. Like, this young man, the grasp that I have on life and in humanity and myself as a man, and now having that, connecting that feminine energy inside of me and still being masculine mm-hmm. and embracing that other side of me that my mom passed on to me, it allowed me to become a better father for him. So now it's just like, and he sees it. So his compassion, his willingness to open up with his emotions, his willingness to be logical about things, but as well having a sense of urgency, knowing that, okay, to be a leader, I have to suck it up sometimes, but not saying that I need to close off from the world, but let me get through this, and there's going to be a time and a place where I could release this.
Yeah.
So, hey, Pops, let's can I talk to you? Or let's have a talk. So, like, this man, like, he makes me so happy, and I'm just blessed that I was honored to be part of his life coming into this world. So I don't own him. And that's one thing I realized as a father and as a parent. He came into this world. He came from us, but he's not for us. He's for the rest of the world. So I make sure that, you know, before I even said love, like, we're going to learn respect first, because I got to learn how to respect you first before you can love me. I don't expect you to automatically love me because you're my child, but I'm going to show you that I love you through the way I treat you and talk to you. So we're going to learn the respect first. Then we'll have that love.
John's life has been anything but ordinary. From the highs of football stardom to the challenges of the Marines and beyond, he's learned what it means to live a healthy, fulfilling life. Now he's embracing his ancestral roots and sharing that peace and purpose with others. If you've been inspired by this story or any others, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review.
We don't just get away at the beach, we get together. Because no matter what floats your boat, we're floating right along with you. With over 2,000 restaurants, live music all day and night, and endless attractions, Myrtle Beach was made for having fun and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 miles where you belong, the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.